Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. The panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofano. Understand we have some interns here, is that right? Well, welcome to appellate argument. You may decide that this is something you want to do forever, but then again, you may not. We have two cases set for oral submission this afternoon, and I understand the first case is the both sides are ready, so we could call the first case, please.
The court will now call Amy Fine and Anna Sabino versus Sunmere Corporation and the Big Texas Department of Transportation. May it please the court, Wisconsin Lynn Moffett will argue for the appellant. Wisconsin Lynn will argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. This case, as the court well knows, involves three different entities. It did involve three different entities. One was the City of Grapevine. The court issued opinion on that case, and it was reversed on grounds that are not relevant to this case. It was actually the City of Grapevine was involved, but they did not own or control any property. And I remember in the last case, the case that was before this court previously, whether or not they had, done anything with any of the property, either the real property or the tangible personal property that was located at the intersection, the barrels and so forth. There was evidence that they did move and make a right-hand lane out of the barrels, but that was on the, like I said, right side, and the problem in this case is where the intersection was blocked on the left, and there was difficulty in seeing. The state and contention that the state did not know or that Sunmount did not know about the incident, because the City of Grapevine officials have testified that both the city and that the city had told them that had two meetings, I believe, at the intersection, and it was basically to let them know that there was a dramatic increase in accidents, and I think that's how they phrased it, dramatic increase in accidents. One of the things I noticed in going through the materials, though, is that the state and Sunmount are using the wrong standard, I believe, as far as whether as far as liability, when they're saying that they had to, if the plaintiff knew of the condition, they had no other duty. And in looking over the liability, if the plaintiff is a licensee, the condition that with respect to the condition of the premises, the defendant, in this case, the state and Sunmount, were negligent if the condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm, which has been proved by the many different accidents in the at the intersection prior to this one, and the defendant had actual knowledge of the danger, which they did. This was brought out by all the depositions by the city employees and city officials, that the plaintiff did not have actual knowledge of the danger until she got to the intersection and was trying to see if any vehicles were coming from the left. She did not have any idea that there was, in fact, she was following road signs saying this is the way to go to the mall. And so she had no actual knowledge of what the danger was. And then the defendant failed to exercise ordinary care to protect the plaintiff from the danger by both, it's not just one or the other, both failing to adequately warn the plaintiff of the condition and failing to make the condition reasonably safe. Now, Sunmount and Texas did nothing to make the condition reasonably safe, and I don't think there's any appellee has not argued differently. They haven't said anything about what they've done because they did nothing. So as far as any kind of warning, they, I think they're trying to put themselves in the city's position because the city was found not to have controlled property at the intersection and did not own or control the intersection. And that's just not the case here because Sunmount was controlling it, the intersection, and the state did own the intersection. So basically, the city really had no liability as far as to a licensee, and that would be anyone driving through the intersection.
What, how do you get around our holding in the prior appeal that our holding that the obstruction was a premises defect about which the plaintiffs had adequate warning?
Well, I don't think, I think in that, I've compared it to, in this particular opinion, in the city's opinion, it really didn't make any difference because the court had gone on to say and held that the city did not own or control the intersection. And it was based on what the city did take control of some of the barrels that were on the right side of the intersection, but that wasn't the cause of the problem. The city basically had no duty to warn or to make it safe. And I don't think they could have because they didn't own the property and they didn't control it. So basically, the difference is who the parties are and what their obligations were based on a premises liability claim.
Was that issue discussed, whether they had owned or controlled any of the property in the prior appeal?
Yes. I believe that Justice Gardner had mentioned that, or had written that they did control, because there was evidence that they moved some of the traffic barrels to make a right-hand turn lane. I'm sorry. I don't have my glasses on because I can't read with my glasses, and so I have to take them off. So I'm sorry, but
actually, it's all three on the same panel.
Yeah. Well, anyway, if you recall, there was evidence that the city did move property at the intersection. If they take control, that's what the court was saying, that if they take control of the property, then they could be responsible for any accidents that were caused by that. But that was all on the right, and it was undisputed that the obstruction division and the problem that they were having was to the left of the intersection. So I don't believe that had any bearing on the case as far as how they held with the city. As far as I think you were asking about the duty to warn or to make safe, that's how they did it, and I think I put that in my brief. As far as it was up to their discretion how to make it safe. A warning, obviously, the fact that it was a construction area, that was obvious. But as far as the specific problem, as far as not being able to see once you got to the intersection, that was something that was caused, actually, was a condition that was brought on by Sunmount. It wasn't even in the traffic control plan. The traffic barriers that they had erected were erected because they cut too deep at that portion in the intersection. And when they cut too deep, then they had to put the concrete barriers up so that it protected the cars that were coming. But that wasn't in the traffic control plan. They never had that discussed with the people that did the engineers that did the traffic control plan. They did that on their own. And in addition to that, besides the concrete barriers, they put road close signs up that weren't in the traffic control plan. They took down the speed limit signs that were supposed to be, they were 45 miles per hour, and they forgot to put up, or they didn't put up during the whole construction on this intersection, the 30 mile per hour reduced speed limit signs. So all I guess in conjunction with everything, it was a very unsafe intersection. And the thing is, too, people that were driving by thought it was 45 miles per hour, and I'm sure that anyone who went to the intersection, especially when they're being led to go to the intersection, saying this way to the Grapevine Mills Mall, and it's undisputed that the plaintiffs had never been to even Grapevine, let alone to the mall, they wouldn't expect there to be an intersection where you're supposed to turn and that there'd be cars going 45 miles per hour and no stop sign or light or anything else indicating that there's a problem. The expert that for the plaintiffs had a number of things that could have been done to make the intersection safe. Even though the city pleaded with the construction company and also with the state, they said, well, it's not in our budget. It was a $10 million project, and they said putting up a $22,000 light was not in their budget. And that was the reason. It had nothing else to do, it was just money. It's very telling that at the, motions in limine that we were talking about the case and the judge was giving rulings, and he granted a summary judgment that he had, months before, looked over all the evidence, and the court can see how much evidence was in the motion for summary judgment. And at this hearing on motions in limine, before we were to start trial, and I don't know how many trial settings we've had. We had one before Christmas, but it interfered with his trip to Russia, and then we had the motions to limine, and all of a sudden he decided, without the benefit of any case law or any of the evidence, decided to grant a motion for summary judgment. And it's very telling on the reporter's record on the third, I think it's the third volume, where the very final thing the judge says, well, when the case is returned from the court or something to that, when it is, and he says, well, when or if it's returned, from the court. I don't think he had any doubt that this was going to be reversed. Sunmount does not have any kind of immunity based on the Texas Tort Claims Act. And because they have no immunity, and in fact, because they took the responsibility, signed a contract with the state saying that they would be fully responsible for the safety at the intersection of the traveling public, for that reason, there's no way that that they have any, in this particular case, any excuse for not making the intersection safe, other than money, other than it would cost them, some money to put up a light. The state had said that if they wanted to put up a light, in fact, they actually did. The city did it. The city did it 5 days after this accident. They put up a traffic light, and it reduced it to one every other month, I believe it was. So basically, there was a way of making it safe, and when the city officials approached Sunmount and the state, they said that they couldn't do it because of, they don't have it in the budget. And then when the city did an emergency movement to get the light funded by the city council, and it was erected, then right after that, they went back to how it was before when there was, no construction and at the intersection. So, for those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that the court was in error, that a summary judgment should not have been granted under these facts. That if you look at the definition, and it's from State versus Williams, 940 Southwest 2nd 583, Texas Supreme Court decision. That's what they base the premises liability if the plaintiff is a licensee on, and it's what I read to the court. And basically, they didn't do anything. They didn't warn, and I don't think that anyone could say that a warning's adequate if you get to the intersection and you can't back up. It's a two-lane area. There's no way of getting, you either go across or I don't know how else they would do, there's no way to turn around. And as I said, they're going uphill because the cut was so deep, it was 5 feet more than it was supposed to be, so they had to put up concrete barriers. So you're going uphill in addition to having the concrete barriers once you get there, and you just couldn't see the traffic that was coming.
So you want us to change our determination of the underlying facts. And you want us to determine that she she did not have adequate notice? Is that what you're asking us to do?
Your Honor, I don't think I'm trying to separate because, you know, it depends on what, you know, she had knowledge when she got there. She had knowledge that her view was blocked. That's and she couldn't do anything about it. But it says, it doesn't say you can do one or the other, you can warn of. If that doesn't make it reasonably safe by having a warning, whether or not it's put up by the state or someone or whoever saying, you know, warning, you can't see traffic coming from your left.
So your position is that despite the warning, despite adequate warnings, what?
Well, I was going to say, Your Honor, as far as I don't think there could be an adequate warning. I don't think in this scenario there could be an adequate warning. But it does say, it says by both, failing to adequately warn of the condition and failing to make the condition reasonably safe. And I don't see how it was made reasonably safe, even if they put up a big sign and said, warning, you can't see traffic from the left. By the time she got to the intersection, which was where the signs led them to, the public, it was really too late. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I think one thing that's very important as you review the arguments in the brief and the pleadings that have been filed with you, this is a premises case. This is not a negligent activity case. And much of what you just heard and much of what's in the briefing deals with activities and not the condition of the premises at the time of the accident. And I also think that there's been confusion created in the briefing before you about the conditions that were present at this intersection. One was the lack of a temporary traffic signal. That was what was addressed a great deal in your original opinion in this case and what the Supreme Court addressed. The appellants in this case have always asserted and have only asserted that the failure to install a temporary traffic signal was the fault of the City of Grapevine. So that's not really before you. The other condition that really was the subject of the summary judgments, which were granted by Judge Lowe below, were the existence of barricades, signs, barrels, and other implements at the intersection on the left, which the appellants assert blocked their view. And of course, since we're in a summary judgment, we have to assume that what they presented to you or presented to Judge Lowe is true. Obviously, that's disputed, but that's not before you. And that's the issue that we're talking about. The third condition, which has just been raised in argument again, is the failure to change a speed limit sign for the eastbound traffic. And the reason I just want to address that to you, Your Honors, is that when you look at the orders granting the motion for summary judgment, Judge Lowe carved that out because that was not addressed in the motions that we filed on behalf of TxDOT and Sunmount. And he only granted the summary judgments as to the alleged obstruction of vision on the left. After the summary judgments were granted, appellants amended their pleadings and dropped all claims about the failure to change the speed limit so that they could come to you on an appeal and not try that issue. So any arguments that you hear, Your Honors, about a failure to change the speed limit isn't in front of you because those claims were left live at the trial court and the appellants decided to dismiss those. Now, Your Honor, what I had intended to do was to point out, as we did in our brief, why the summary judgment should be affirmed without ever getting to the issues of collateral estoppel or law of the case. I did want to address why we do believe your original holding does apply on the seminal issue in this case, and that's notice and warning if we get to warning. But before, and then of course I had a cross appeal that I wanted to address just briefly. But before I move on, are there any specific issues that you would like me to address since you've read the briefs and, of course, you heard this case before? And if so, I'll move directly to those issues. All right. Feel free to interrupt me at any time, obviously, as I'm sure you would. One of the things that we pointed out is that the summary judgments filed both by TxDOT and Sunmount, and they were separate, had three bases to be granted. The first two were the collateral estoppel and the law of the case issue that you're holding bound Judge Lowe, and he had to grant the summary judgments. But for both Sunmount and TxDOT, we raised a third issue that appellants haven't complained about before you. And so for that reason, the summary judgment should be affirmed just because error wasn't assigned. And specifically on Sunmount, we presented you summary judgment proof that the appellants knew about the condition, this alleged inability to see because of obstructions on the left side. And I will have to respectfully disagree with my opposing counsel, but as you said in your first opinion, if they are a licensee, which is assumed in this case, and everyone agrees that they were, my only duty as Sunmount and TxDOT is to not wantonly or willfully injure them. However, if there's a condition about which I knew and the appellants did not, then we get to either warn or make safe. It is not conjunctive. It is, I can't remember which one's which. It's either you have to warn or make safe. So what's important, Your Honors, is that if appellants had actual knowledge of the condition, we don't even get to warning, and we don't even get to whether we should have made it safe, because those only are triggered if we knew and she did not. And opposing counsel just admitted, Your Honors, as they did in their brief, that Mrs. Sipes knew about the inability to see, or at least what she believed was an inability to see. In fact, the summary judgment proof that we presented before Judge Lowe was that she and her daughter, who was sitting in the passenger seat, both discussed that they couldn't see, both discussed what they should do. Should they pull out in the intersection? Should they turn around? What should they do with the fact that they couldn't see? And they chose to pull out. So it is undisputed that the appellants knew about what they allege was the dangerous condition. And it was just like the case that we cited.
They didn't know until they got to the middle of it, right?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. They knew when they got to the intersection that they couldn't see, because they testified in their depositions and in the summary judgment record that when they stopped twice. They stopped at the little white stop bar, and then they pulled up to the stop sign, so before they entered the intersection. And they both testified in their deposition that when they looked to their left, they felt that they couldn't see. They discussed it, and they decided to pull out, and just to see then if there was any traffic coming, and unfortunately there was.
I don't recall, is there any evidence that they had no alternative but to go forward, that they were caught at that point?
Not in the summary judgment record, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's my recollection from the deposition is that there were several roads. And as I said, there was the stop bar and then the stop sign. I think she testified in her deposition that there were no other vehicles in front of her or behind her. So there's nothing in the record that said she had no option but to pull out into the road. And in one of the Supreme Court cases that we cited, it was the Lower Neches Valley, and I probably mispronounced that. In that particular case, it was where the gentleman dove into the canal. He said, I knew that there were possible lumps of clay in the canal, but I dove in anyway. And he argued that the state entity that maintained the canals owed him a duty to warn about the lumps of clay that might injure him. And the Supreme Court said, no, he knew they were there before he dove in, and therefore there was no warning necessary, even though he couldn't see them. And that's even more egregious than what we have here when we have the appellants who said they knew there was a problem, and yet they pulled out. It's like a washed-out bridge, Your Honor. If they were to pull up and see that a bridge in front of them had washed out, and they say, I can't back up, I have to drive forward, and then sue the city for not putting a sign out that the bridge was washed out. That doesn't make any sense, but more important, Your Honor, that doesn't put liability. And because the appellants did not assign error to that portion of the motion for summary judgment, it needs to be affirmed. TxDOT also argued in their motion for summary judgment that they were entitled to governmental immunity for the same reasons that the city of Grapevine was, because it wasn't a special defect, it was just a premises defect of which both of the appellants had adequate notice and warning. Now, when you look at the record, you will note that TxDOT did not include that evidence on their portion of the motion, but the plaintiffs, in their response briefing, provided all of the same evidence and testimony that was before you in the City of Grapevine appeal. And of course, when you review a summary judgment, it's my understanding from the review of Rule 166A, you look at the entire record, not just what the appellant, the movements put into the record. and the record will show that TxDOT is entitled to the same immunity that the city of Grapevine was, and therefore, because that hasn't been challenged on appeal, then that should be affirmed. We do think, Your Honor, however, that your ruling on the previous appeal that the appellants both had notice and adequate warning is binding for under both the law of the case and collateral estoppel. And the law of the case is clear. The two complaints that have been made by appellants are that it's not the same case and it's a factual finding by you and not a legal issue, and both of those are clearly not true. The appellants even agreed when the appeal was ongoing with the City of Grapevine that the City of Grapevine was an essential party and requested the court to abate the underlying case until the appeal was over. It's clear, same facts, same evidence, same accident. The issues are the same. All of the parties are the same, except the City of Grapevine was dismissed, that we are in the same case. And then, of course, as we cited one of the cases out of the Waco Court of Appeal, out of Dallas, the Kaplaner case, which was directly on point that the prior granting of a motion for summary judgment is a legal conclusion because it is a summary judgment as opposed to a jury finding, and therefore that triggers law of the case. So what we have, Your Honor, is that you ruled that the appellants had adequate notice and adequate warning. And I do want to point out, I have seen 4 or 5 times the argument that all you had was a prepositional phrase of adequate notice or adequate warning, and that's just not correct, Your Honors, as you, I'm sure you knew because you wrote the opinion. You wrote in your opinion, by appellants' own admissions, they knew they were entering a construction zone, and Mrs. Sipes, the driver, admitted that there were sufficient signs to alert her to unexpected dangers at the intersection. That was your holding. And your holding was also essential to what we did below because the City of Grapevine, whether or not they owned and controlled the intersection, was actually not ever part of your ruling. And of course, I don't know why I'm telling you what your ruling was because it was yours. But when you read the opinion, what you will see is that the City of Grapevine argued that they didn't have control over the intersection or ownership over the intersection. And you noted that in your opinion. What you also noted is that there was evidence that they played a significant role in whether to put up a temporary traffic signal, that they had moved barricades and warning signs on the other side of the intersection. You pointed out that under governmental immunity in the use of tangible personal property, there's no requirement for ownership before liability triggers. And then you also pointed out that under governmental immunity, that a governmental entity can have liability for a condition of a premises just as a private person would. And as you well know, in the Stracos case by the Texas Supreme Court, they held liability to a party who created a dangerous condition, even though that party did not have control or ownership over the intersection. So the only way that you could affirm Judge Lowe's original summary judgment that because you had found it was a premise defect, that the City of Grapevine did not have any liability was to find, as you did, that the appellants had adequate notice and adequate warning. So your holding was essential to your affirmation of that part of the summary judgment below. And because of that, it both applies to the law of the case and it applies under collateral estoppel. And it is just not appropriate, nor right, nor allowed under the law for the appellants to go back to Judge Lowe and say, I know that the Court of Appeals has already ruled on this, but I didn't like it and I want you to rule again. That's not allowed. You've made a finding on notice and warning, and that's binding. And because this is also a premise defect and not a special defect, that finding alone supports the motions for summary judgment that the appellants had adequate notice and adequate warning. And as I pointed out, we don't even have to get to warning because it is undisputed in the briefing and in the summary judgment record that the appellants knew of the condition before they pulled out into the intersection. So therefore, because they had knowledge, that was all that Sunmount had to do. And then just briefly, Your Honors, we did file a motion for, a cross appeal on the failure of Judge Lowe to award court costs. And I just want to point that out, Your Honor, because we showed, as you well know, that court costs are to be awarded to the prevailing party unless there's good cause in the record. And that was not challenged by cross-appellees. What was asserted is that the cross-appellants waived that argument because we submitted a judgment that did not include cost of court. And when you look at the court reporter's supplemental record, I think it may have been the second supplemental record, you will see the letters where I submitted on behalf of my clients a judgment that included the award of court cost, that appellant's attorney submitted a contrary judgment that did not include the award of court cost, and Judge Lowe chose to sign the one that appellant's counsel submitted and not mine. So there's no waiver, and because there was no showing of good cause, the summary judgment should be affirmed and court costs should be awarded. Thank you.
Your Honors, as far as the fact that it was a construction zone, I don't think that anyone has ever disputed the fact that it was a construction zone and that they were aware of this fact. That does not mean, as far as if it was a construction zone, as far as speeding through it, doing something like that, there's nothing that indicates that the plaintiffs did not know that they had no stop sign for the traffic that was coming from the left. They couldn't see anything on that side. So basically, when they came up to the intersection, it's completely blind. You wouldn't expect a construction area to have a place where you can't see traffic coming and not have a stop sign or something to prevent accidents from happening. That was their responsibility, and there's no doubt that the plaintiffs stopped. There's no doubt that they tried to see, you know, any kind of traffic coming. They had no idea that there was nothing keeping the traffic from stopping or from them from seeing more when they pulled out. As far as the amended the petition, the judge was going to go forward on this case on just based on the fact that they took down speed limit signs and didn't put them back up. We have 5 experts on the case. 3 of them are damage experts, but 2 of them are liability experts. And basically, to go through the case based on SunMount not putting back up the traffic or speed limit signs wouldn't have had any effect whatsoever on the case, because it's really not being able to see. That's just one of many things that was wrong at the intersection. The visibility problem was a big factor. And I think that since it wasn't the holding of this court as far as on the traffic light was something that was what it went up to the Texas Supreme Court for. It was basically that when they didn't have ownership or control of the intersection, but the thing is when they made the decision to put up a traffic light and they didn't do it within a reasonable time, that was the law before the Texas Supreme Court reversed on that particular ground. As far as the positions of the party, it's very important to realize that SunMount is not protected by governmental immunity, number one, but number two, they're different parties as far as what their role was in it. The city really didn't have anything. The court pointed out that the city's only, actions as far as this intersection was moving barrels to the right, and that had nothing to do with this collision. So, like I said, for all they knew, that why would you have an intersection where you can't see unless you had some kind of safeguard, that like a stop sign for the traffic that was coming? They also, there's evidence that they did not see any cars passing as they were coming up. They could have even seen that this was a road closed sign. I mean, basically, they could have thought that the road was closed. But to say it is an adequate warning and this is a matter of law, I think the court has to to look at all the circumstances and the fact that the premises liability, issue that a jury would have to determine would be the knowledge of both parties, and also as far as who had control of the intersection and who had owned the property.
May I read you a couple of lines of testimony from Ms. Waddell's deposition?
Yes.
What could you see to your left? Answer, I could see cement barriers, I could see orange barrels, I could see a big road close sign that was completely blocking our vision of what was over to the left if there were any oncoming cars. Doesn't that establish that she had knowledge? I realize she was the passenger, but that she had actual knowledge, not just that they were in a construction zone, but that their vision was blocked.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that yes, their vision was blocked, and they knew that when they. But they also said that there's a road close sign, and there's two road close signs, so it looked like that road was closed. I mean, as far as they were concerned, she had her deposition taken after the collision, after they were broadsided by a truck that came barreling down at 45 miles per hour and hit them. So basically, when she was having her deposition taken, she said that they didn't see any cars coming. Why wouldn't they have thought that that was the road close sign? If you have a blocked intersection and you can't see, it's the visibility problem is so dangerous that why would you expect it not to be, them not to have a stop sign or have or the road being actually closed? Mm-hmm. And actually, after they were hit, obviously they knew that the road wasn't closed. They didn't see any vehicles coming, and they pulled out, and everyone else who went to that intersection did the same thing. So I think there has to be some bearing on who was in the position to do something about it. And the state and Sunmont both, could have. They didn't follow the traffic control plan. The reason those barricades were up there is because they dug too deep, because they didn't follow the traffic control plan. And so they had, in fact, that's the representative for Sunmont, Andrew Foster. Andrew Foster testified to that. It was 5 feet rather than being 2 or 2.5 feet as far as what they dug and why they had to put up those concrete barriers. That's in his deposition. So basically, Your Honors, they didn't follow the traffic control plan, and the requirement for them was to make the owner of the intersection or the one who controlled the intersection is to make it safe, and they did not do that. If a warning's not sufficient, then.
Thank you. All right, your case is submitted again. We appreciate your argument and your briefing.